Namaste. Firstly, my gratitude to Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. I have been visiting here since the year 2000. And those who are familiar with my journey are aware that the Triangle of Chennai, Tiruvannamalai, and Pondicherry has been one I have covered for the last 25 years. I have written about my thoughts on the mother in a chapter of my new book, Heart to Heart. Those who are interested in reading it could get the book. I am also blessed that I am married to someone who is immersed in their teachings. And such immersion is very rare to see. And so I imbibe a lot by the words she says about what they have said. And recently, perhaps just a year ago, I had the good fortune of meeting Narad. In my 25 years of trips here, I had not met him. But finally, our paths crossed. And from the time I saw him, I knew that not only was he a beloved friend, but someone I felt most comfortable with. Someone whose silence speaks to me more than having a conversation with him. Nisargadatta Maharaj said, realized people are very quiet. So to me, this quietness, which is not the absence of speech, it is an inner stillness which comes through in the presence of a person. This, fortunately, is very evident to me when I see it in people. Now, coincidentally, today is Mauni Amavasya, the silent no moon. Very interestingly, as Ramana Maharshi said, if you think words are powerful, can you imagine how much more powerful is silence from which the words emerge? There are four stages of speech. Para Pashyanti Madhyama Vekhari. First is the source. Then a thought stirs, takes form in words, and comes out as speech. All words come from silence and dissolve into silence. And words have weight. Maharaj said, words have weight. And once they are released, they land on the earth because they have weight. So the words we speak, the way we express ourselves, reveals our inner state. Are they hurtful words, toxic words, words about getting back at people for what they have said to me, and so on and so forth? Now, in this talk, I would like to attempt what I spoke about on the last day of the Thiruvannamalai retreat, which is not spoken much about, at least in the Advaita and non-duality circles, which is the theory of karma. The theory of karma as we know it, non-duality, and deep peace, sukha shanti. Deep peace, which is true happiness. And how we have the potential in this lifetime to end the cycle of karma. Now, for those who believe in the theory of birth and rebirth and reincarnation, they will certainly resonate with the theory of karma and what I will speak about it very briefly. I am not an academic. I am not immersed in theory. My experience has been peace and harmony in daily living. But there's a bridge which I will attempt to construct to show how we can understand the theory of karma and get out of this endless cycle of birth and rebirth. And to those who don't believe in past lives or future lives, if we look at this life itself, we are living many past lives and many future lives in this one life. When we are in the dead past, we are reliving the past. When we are anxious about our future, we are creating a future filled with anxiety in this life. So we are reincarnating into our thinking mind again and again in this life itself. This is the gift of Advaita, which I hope to share. I'm going to crunch a lot into just an hour and a half, so please bear with me if it gets heavy. The talk will be available on YouTube later for you to go through. But it is most important because anyone immersed in sadhana must ask themselves one question. Am I more peaceful now than I was before? That is the litmus test. I am quite familiar with the works of the mother. I have not read them in depth, but whatever I have read about what she says resonates deeply with me. So I find what I speak to be an expression of that same force. So we must first understand the very basics. According to the theory of karma, there are four types of karma. One is the mountain heap of karma, which is akarma. That is called sanchit karma. But that mountain is so enormous that it is impossible to process that mountain heap in one lifetime. So by the grace of the source, just a small part of that is given to us for this lifetime, enough for us to process. And that is called prarabdha karma. The karma we are assigned to go through in this lifetime. Now we come to the present life. In the present life, there are two kinds of karma. One is a karma, an action I perform, the effect of which is squared off instantly. For example, I slap someone and they slap me back. It's done. The other is agami karma. I do something, but the effect takes place maybe after a year, 5 years, 10 years, or not, carried forward to the next birth. For example, I borrow money from someone and I say I'll pay you back in a year and I don't. So the reaction to the action is kept pending. Now, those of us who live unconscious lives are recreating karmic patterns and adding to the heap of karma, which is the sanchit karma, endlessly. And the cycle goes on and on and on. And to come under the grace of a guru is one thing. But to walk the talk, to live the teachings, is quite something else. And we will see how the external manifest world cannot be excluded from my journey of self-discovery. Now let us understand the ego. The ego is identification with name and form as a separate entity. When the baby is born, the baby is pure being, pure consciousness, referred to as Bal Krishna. But by and by, this baby is given a name and is trained to respond to the name. And this baby sees eventually, if I do something, like if I cry, someone comes running to me. And that someone says, she is my mother. So the ego is not formed at birth, but sets in when the sense of separation sets in, perhaps after a year or so. That is the birth of identification. And this ego, by and by, gets conditioned by the background of the parents, their income group, their religion, their worldviews. And this innocent child has now started receiving a bombardment of conditioning and thinks, this is who I am. These are my views, my beliefs, my opinions. When the joke is, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. The same child is running around the house. Let's say his parents are rich. They have expensive curios lying all over the place. And the child knocks one down. And the parent screams at the child, what did you do? And so this sense of doership, which the child was not familiar with, I didn't do anything, that starts getting ingrained in the child. The belief, I am the doer and so are you. It is this sense of doership which starts destroying my peace of mind. This is very important to understand that if I express myself, whatever I am saying is based on only two factors, my genetics and my conditioning, neither of which were made by me. The forces of nature, totality, the source, God, consciousness, call it what you want, shaped me to think and feel a certain way, just like it shaped the person across me, just like it shaped the person whose views I don't agree with. to live this understanding is to live Advaita. Advaita is a Dvait, not two. Appears as two, is not. Consciousness is all there ever is. But this is an appearance. I don't use the word illusion because there is a misconception about illusion. The manifest world is a reflection of the source within itself, not outside it. If all there is the source, all there is consciousness, a reflection of consciousness cannot be outside consciousness. It can only be within consciousness. So in that sense, the manifest world is not an illusion, but it is an appearance. It is an appearance of the one self, which means that the people in my life I don't get along with, who have triggered me, pushed my buttons the most, are a reflection of the one self. To understand this is imperative to get out of the cycle of birth and rebirth. Imagine if the one self had a form, which it doesn't, but just imagine it did, and stood in front of a mirror, all it would see is itself. There would be no other because there is nothing apart from the source. So this ego, when it starts realizing nobody is really the doer of the actions, they appear to be, no doubt, but I don't know the person in front of me, what shaped them to say what they do and do what they do. I don't know their backstory. Who am I to judge? So where's the question of blame and condemnation? For someone who is an instrument of the divine, just as I am. Where is this need to be obsessive about people's flaws when they have not created the flaws themselves? And why not have the understanding that if I am quick to find fault with someone, it only means one thing, that I must have faults myself. So, to understand this is critical. And this brings us to understanding life, the structure of life is duality. We are all born into a dual universe. Duality of every conceivable kind. The simple duality of left and right, up and down, black and white, rich and poor, pleasure and pain. Everyone has an experience of both in their lives. We are born into the dual universe. We cannot escape it. But a primary polarity is me and the other, which has become me versus the other. Me and the other is the manifest world, you and me. But the training began since we were young to make it you versus me. And therein lies our suffering. Therein lies conflict. And therein is our peace to be found. We have conveniently separated the people in our lives to those who we love and those who love me, and those who have really troubled me, who don't agree with me, who have a problem with what I say. And so they are blocked from my love, so to speak. Whereas those are my greatest teachers. That is where I will learn unconditional love, a total acceptance of people the way God created them. Not a conditional acceptance. You love me, so I love you. A total acceptance of people the way God created them, without wanting them to be any other way or telling them, don't be like this, be like this, playing God. We all are guilty of the crime of playing God by trying to tell people how they should behave. This is the original sin in Advaita. The one true subject, I have usurped the subjectivity of the source and I have started pronouncing judgment on everyone. Without realizing, I too am merely an instrument through whom God's will functions. This is the original sin. Or in the words of the American mystic Joel Goldsmith, Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden when they took from the tree of knowledge, the knowledge of good and evil. When we created good and evil, we split the source into the dualistic universe and preferred the good over the evil. Not realizing good and evil are just polarities of the one source consciousness. And it is this split which has destroyed our peace of mind. And Joel Goldsmith, who I consider a healer who produced healings based on the principle of Advaita, complete non-doership, used to tell his students only two things. Give up the belief in two powers. There is no power apart from God. Which my teacher would say, consciousness is all there is. And two, the one word he consistently hammered, impersonalize. He would tell his students, impersonalize error. The minute you feel something is wrong with someone, a personality trait, a character, whatever it may be, impersonalize it. Because the person didn't do it purposely. But we are accusing the person of that. It is just the carnal mind under whose influence the person is, which is making them say and do things. And in impersonalizing error, the healing takes place, according to his teaching, so close to Advaita. So when we start living our lives, knowing nobody is the doer of their actions, we find a tremendous sense of peace. Start settling into ourselves. To me, that is the first step in the transformation of the cells, which these great masters speak about. The peace must settle in the cells. The peace must eradicate past judgments by seeing them in a new light. Nobody did anything to me. Reinterpreting my past. Understanding it in the light of not to. Understanding everyone has come with their own blueprint, their own script. Some will love me, some will hurt me. That is the nature of life and living. But the to me is the problem. Personalizing it, this strong sense of personhood, which is battling to survive in the world. Why? Because if I have a point of view, I must defend it. especially if you have the opposite point of view. Because if I don't defend my point of view, what will happen? I will die. See, the ego is only concerned with avoiding death. It wants to live. And anything which threatens this is perceived as a dire threat. Whereas the ego was meant to be only the functional element in daily living. Decision has to be taken, it is taken. Knowing the results are not in my control, have never been in my control. It was merely the functional element. But what happened is, it became the be-all, this is me. But the cosmic joke is, we all have the experience of deep sleep, which you will agree with me is most peaceful. Everyone wakes up from deep sleep and says, I slept well. But you were not present in deep sleep. Deep sleep was the absence of you. And that is why it was peaceful. The absence of a separate sense of self is what deep sleep is. This is the troublemaker. In the waking state, the me and my story, me and mine, that one must step aside. For the peace of conscious presence, pure being, conscious being, to shine through. Always ever present, always there, from the time you're a child, right here, right now, even in the deep sleep state, but the veil of Maya has covered it. And this teaching is a lifting of the veil. The light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness comprehend it not. The darkness of the ego cannot comprehend the light does not mean the light is not there. It is always ever shining. And this becomes the pivot in the Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 3, verse 27. I am no Gita expert. But chapter 3, verse 27, which says, everything happens according to the qualities of nature. Everything happens according to the three qualities of nature, the gunas, sattva, rajas, tamas. But the ego-deluded thinks, I am the doer. And that is why my teacher would use that only one example, the main point in the battle, when Arjuna tells Lord Krishna, look here, I see all of these people in front of me. I can kill all of them, no problem. But I will not kill my preceptors. And Arjuna decides to put his bow and arrow down and refuses to fight. And the Lord tells him, look here, let's just look at this situation in the light of clarity. You have been born into a warrior caste. You have been trained all your life as a warrior. You are the one most perfected to fight. Yet, you think you are doing the killing. Whereas I, as the Lord of Time, have already killed them. And you are merely the instrument through whom God's will function. And that is the moment Arjuna picks up the bow and arrow and it begins. So it is all there for us. And I too know how fond and how intimate Lord Krishna is with Sri Aurobindo's life and works. It is just laid bare in front of us. You see, as they say, the truth is hidden in plain sight. Only the perspective needs to change. That is all. When we absolve the person in front of us in this life of doership, the turning of the wheel has begun. Then I will no longer start adding to the stockpile of karma. Now there's a limit. That is the importance of this birth, spiritual awakening in this birth. It stops what was unconscious activity of the thinking mind of the ego, disengages it. How? It's so simple. If my mind is no longer full of the garbage of hatred, malice, ill will, condemnation, blame, pride, arrogance, guilt, and shame, my mind is completely vacant, available, pure being, and honoring the person in front of me, whoever they may be. Wouldn't you call it the end of karma? Whereas we are not available when we are in front of people. Our minds are going all over the place. But it's so simple. If everyone is an instrument of God, wouldn't you agree with me that God is standing in front of you? If your version of God was standing in front of you, would your mind be running left and right? But an ordinary person is chatting with you, you lose interest, you don't honor the presence, you're thinking of past resentments, regrets, and so on. Isn't it absurd? The thinking mind is an absurd distortion. So what is this end of karma? Being in the present moment, not seeing everyone constantly through old filters, seeing them in a new light, seeing the same person in a new light, the same troublemaker in a new light, and understanding. That I am seeing an aspect of the one divine. That is all. Then a beautiful transformation happens. When you see the hand of God above everyone, no matter who they are, now your relationship changes from your relationship with individuals to your relationship with God. It's very obvious. Now your relationship is with God. I would call that the ultimate bhakti. There's this whole talk of bhakti yoga being one way, jnana yoga being separate. I do not know a more intimate form of bhakti than seeing God in everyone. Mostly our bhakti is conditional bhakti. Me and my relationship with my deity, my rituals, my worship. But what about all of creation? How can I love parts of God and not the others? It's really a distortion. The carnal mind, as Goldsmith says, it does not mean that you love those who have tortured you. It means you accept the will of God, the totality that in your life, pleasure and pain were assigned to you, and all you can do is meet them with an attitude which conserves your peace of mind, which is Buddha's entire teaching was that. Samsara is dukkha, nirvana is shanti, but they are not two. The world is full of sorrow and suffering, nirvana is peace, they are not two. You cannot find your peace away from the world. You cannot run to a cave. It won't happen. You have to find your peace through it. That is the sadhana. how much more will you run away? And so, this Gujarati gentleman, Hirabhai Thakkar, I read his book, The Theory of Karma. It's decades old, this book, slim book. Lot of it fear-based, no doubt, and especially Hindus have this fear of bad karma and they try to square off the karmic accounts by doing good karma and so on. But there was one very beautiful example which brings me to the importance of the present birth. You may ask, this mountain heap of Sanchit karma, the Prada karma of this life, so on and so forth, is there no way out? How do I get out of this? And that is what we've spoken about. So Hirabhai Thakkar gives a beautiful example. He says, imagine you are having a dream at night. And in the dream, you have committed a murder. You are caught and you are sentenced to jail for 20 years. This is your dream. You do 4 years out of 20 years. By the fourth year, you have been tortured, abused. The jail warden hates you. And one night in your dream, the jail warden comes and beats you up. And he beats you so hard that you scream and wake out of the dream. The dream is finished. Now you're awake in your bed. What happened to the murder? What happened to the jail warden? What happened to the 4 years? What about the next 16 years of the dream punishment? They are all gone. Finished. Why? You're out of the dream. You have awakened to your true self and you are no longer the dreamed character in the dream. This is what spiritual awakening is. The opportunity to come out of this living dream of life, this realm of separation, to be established in Sakshi Bhav, witness consciousness, not too quick to react like I have been doing all the time. Someone pushes me here, I react, pushes me here, I react. But seeing the divine play and seeing how a deep understanding now changes a knee-jerk reaction to a response. To be established in that state, a state of full potential, full awareness, that is the opportunity. And so someone asked a similar question to Ramana Maharshi. They said, we can understand for Jnani, an enlightened being, the mountain heap is gone of Sanchit karma. Certainly, he is not perpetuating further karma with agami karma, etc. But doesn't a jnani have to face prarabdha karma? How can you escape the karma assigned to you in this lifetime? Nobody can escape it because you're in the flesh. So Ramana Maharshi replied and said exactly what was mentioned by Hirabhai Thakkar in the example of the dream, which I'd like to read out. Because you see, understanding this provides significant hope for all of us. That day, Bhagwan quoted a verse that expounded the truth about the three karmas. Sanchita, which is the karma accumulated from our past lives. Agami, the new karma we create in our present life. And Prarabdha, the karma to be worked out in this life. Now, according to the scriptures, for Jnani, Sanchit Karma and Agami Karma get nullified, but he still has to experience Prarabdha Karma. Ramana Maharshi has rejected this by a humorous analogy. He says, when one is beyond the control of the mind and body, it is not possible to say that two karmas are nullified and that one karma alone will stick to him. Imagine that a man is married to three wives. If he dies, all three will become widowed, not just two. Now, this for me is the linchpin, what he says in the next statement. Just as none of a man's wives can avoid becoming a widow on his death, so also when the doer is gone, none of the three forms of karma survive after that. When the doer is, that is the golden key which is placed before us. That is why chapter 3, verse 27 for me, this what I have read out. In my years of intense working, Sri Aurobindo's secrets of Karma Yoga were just echoing this. The doer needs to dissolve. But life will constantly test us. This concept of doership will come to us again and again and again in different forms, different challenges, until we can master it. Which reminds me of the story of Prahlada. The young lad, and the god came and stood in front of him and says, I will grant you a boon. And Prahlada said, I don't want a boon. You coming here in front of me is enough of a boon. What more do I want? He said, no, now I insist. One boon. He said, all right, my wish is that no harm comes to those who have tortured me. And the Lord is surprised. After all the torture you have received, this is what you're asking. Ask for something else. He said, no. You gave me one wish, this is what I want. So the Lord said, why? He said, it's quite simple. To wish harm upon them is to wish harm upon you because you created them. That is why when Maharaj was asked, is it all about love, love, love? He said, no. Mine is the yoga of harmlessness. Do not harm another, that is all. Nisarga Yoga, the natural state of peace, equanimity, calm, a felt oneness with being. All I ask is don't harm another. Because if we truly realized that consciousness is all there is, would consciousness harm itself? There is no one to love as well. There is no one to love as well because the nature of consciousness is love. Its nature is love. You see, otherwise we get stuck in this polarity of love-hate. The polaric opposite is recreated all the time. It is our own experience right now. I am speaking because I am conscious and you are listening because you are conscious. If I was not conscious, this would be a dead body and you would be dead. So wouldn't it be fair to say that consciousness is speaking through one instrument and listening through the other? So wouldn't it be fair to say consciousness is speaking to itself and listening to itself. But this is so alluring. I am here, you are there, we are separate, and two individuals are speaking to each other. That is the allure, the mesmerism, the hypnotic spell we have been placed under. Gyan, the fire of knowledge, Gyan Agni, is to see. This is the play of consciousness. Consciousness is like a movie. All the villains, all the heroes, all the characters played by consciousness, script written by consciousness, produced by consciousness, directed by consciousness, the screen which is played on is consciousness, and consciousness is watching the movie. Nothing can arise apart from your consciousness. The one you love is as much a part of your consciousness as the one who has troubled you the most, because they are both arising within your own consciousness. Who is closer than whom? Both disappear in deep sleep. Whom are we trying to fool? But the one source consciousness, pure awareness, unaware of itself as awareness, became aware of itself through multiplicity. I am. I am. Became I am you, me, he, she, and the other. And through this multiplicity, it rediscovered itself. That is the joy of rediscovery, to know who I am. But what we did is this I am, we stuck labels on people's foreheads. The sibling who has troubled me, the spouse who I didn't get along with, the friend who's no longer a friend, and so on and so forth. We became obsessive about labeling the individuals in our lives. And this teaching is saying, now peel them off one by one, one by one. Because it is that same one I am, pure being operating through everyone. That is why Jesus Christ on the cross left us with the most beautiful words, Thy will be done, not my will, O Lord, but Thine be done. And Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He did not say, I forgive you. He didn't tell them, I forgive you. Who was he to forgive? He was an instrument through whom God's will functioned. So even on the cross, in excruciating pain, he said, Lord, you forgive them. The main agent is above. And he told Pontius Pilate, when Pilate said, your own people want you dead. I'm just doing my job. And he said, Thou could have no power over me except if it was given to thee from above. Don't worry. You are an instrument through whom this verdict is passed. I know that. There you have the teaching of non-doership, not just in Hinduism. But we are busy crucifying people in our lives all the time. As my teacher would say, life is fundamentally imprisonment. Oh, he said, he was told, how can you be so negative? No, just understand what I'm saying. Pure, boundless consciousness has got restricted to a body. Isn't that imprisonment of sorts? But yet, look at the potential. The potential to realize the boundless consciousness is in this body itself. But what we individuals have done is converted simple imprisonment to rigorous imprisonment by creating endless psychological suffering for ourselves and worse, those in our lives. You see, peace is our birthright. Who are we, forget our own peace, to take away someone else's peace, which is their birthright? Yet we do it when we dominate and control people, try to manipulate them. In my teacher's dying days, someone asked him, you have spoken for decades now. Why don't you leave us with one sentence which is simple, which we can take hold of? And he said, all I say is love each one in your life as if you created them. Love each one, past, present, future, in this life, as if you created them. When this starts happening, this karmic loop, this cause-effect cycle stops. As the Aghori Vimlananda said, effect is cause revealed and cause is effect concealed. We think A leads to B, B leads to C, C leads to D, as my teacher would say, but the arrow of destiny is double pointed. For D to happen, C had to happen. For C to happen, B had to happen. For B to happen, A had to. In his early days, my teacher would say, it's too easy to blame someone. It comes naturally to us. To live the life courageous is to know nobody is the doer of their actions. It takes courage because now the ego has nothing to hold on to. That is the life courageous. And clearly, the end of the thinking mind, which is the ego, marks the end of horizontal time. Not going into the dead past, nor an unknown future, but being right here, right now, in this moment. As Eckhart Tolle said, eternity does not mean endless time, it means no time. So that's all I have to share. I hope it wasn't too heavy. Thank you for coming, for listening. It gives me great joy to share what I have learned over the years. It's nice to pass it on. These are ancient messages. Messengers change with time. It's like in the olden days, a postman would come to your door with a letter, and what you read really transforms you. That what you read is an ancient message. And the postman is merely delivering the letter and knows he is just a postman. The messenger is not the message. The message is the message. And so through the cycle of time, the benevolent divine almighty has constantly given us messengers who've shared the same eternal truth generation after generation after generation. That is all that has happened, that I would call grace. Point is, we just take the letter and put it in our pockets to read it, see our daily life, daily living, and apply it. Purushartha, effort, sadhana, till we don't need the sadhana, till it becomes a default setting, till the understanding goes down to the heart. Then I know this is who I am now. I no longer need to process this new way of thinking, because now I am operating through the heart, which is not the physical heart, but the heart of being, the heart of pure awareness. The Naqshbandi Silsila in Sufism is a heart-based teaching. They actually work on the heart. I belong to the Qadri Silsila. Qadri Silsila is the oldest Silsila. And my Sufi mentor, someone whom so many people come to with their ailments, problems, personal issues. I was just sipping chai with him one day, and he said to me, the greatest teaching is anyone who comes in front of you, including me as a Sufi master. My first thought is, this person before me has good qualities that I don't have. So the highest states boil down to the bare bones. How do you relate to what's in front of you? That's all. The rest is of no practical use. Where my feet are, where I stand on holy ground, is how I am with the other, whoever the other may be. Ramana Maharshi said, the Kundalini is the self. It is not your own individual experience of a Kundalini awakening. The realization is of the one self. That is why there's a very sweet incident where someone came to him with a bar of chocolate, and he counted the number of people in his room, 36 or something, got that slab cut into those many pieces and gave one to each of them. So you, in essence, cannot have a full-blown Kundalini awakening and be a nasty person. Doesn't cut ice. All right. Thank you.